A very good morning to everyone. Our first case on today's call is number 063935, the United States against Patricia Petrie. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen. I'm with the Federal Public Defender for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Patricia Petrie, in this matter. There are two issues before the court this morning, the first being the district court's failure to consider the guideline policy statements when sentencing Ms. Petrie upon revocation of her supervised release. As this court is well aware, the policy statements are non-binding but should be given great weight. This court has so held even after Booker, and it is an abuse of discretion to ignore them completely, as the district court did in this case. In this case, it was a grade C violation based on repeated positive tests for cocaine and drug use, criminal history category 1, which is a range of 3 to 9 months under Chapter 7. The court never mentioned the guidelines during either of the two hearings that are at issue in this case. They were very short hearings based on the probation officer's recommendation, seconded by the government, that she do 18 months to get her into a drug treatment program in the BOP, which, incidentally, she has not been allowed into. At the first hearing, upon defense counsel's request, the judge granted a 30-day continuance, but said, "I'm not going to hear arguments one way or another. If you test positive, you're going away for 18 months." There's no mention at either the first or second hearing of the 3 to 9 months or the guidelines at all.
Wasn't the problem that a certain amount of time was required for her to take the treatment?
That is the issue that was trying to be addressed by the court, that according to BOP, I believe information received by the probation officer, that she would have to have a certain length of sentence in order to qualify. And my experience is that that is true, because there's a waiting list, there's a certain amount of time that's necessary. But in this case, that was the only consideration given by the district court, was getting her into the BOP treatment, which actually didn't happen.
Are you claiming that she was denied a right to allocute at the first or the second hearing, or both?
Well, it's a little unclear because of the way the hearings were split up. But clearly at the second hearing was when definitely the right became invested, because that's when the court sentenced her. But neither time was she given a chance to say anything at all.
Are you contesting the fact that plain error is the applicable standard here?
For the allocution issue?
Mm-hmm.
No, that we admit that plain error is the appropriate standard. She did not request to allocute, although this court has noted in the Barnes case that although that was a situation where the defendant was unable to reassert his right, he asked prior to the hearing, and the judge did not let him allocute. But this court has said that the burden is on the district court, not on the defendant, to seek the right of allocution. And on the plain error analysis, I believe the parties are in somewhat agreement that there was error in this case. The question then becomes the remaining elements of that standard, whether it was plain, whether it affected substance.
In other words, are you in agreement on the interpretation of the 2004 amendment to the rules?
I believe we are in agreement of that, and based on the court's prior case law and other circuits.
Why did the court use drafters in 2004 use a different verbiage than was used in the provision that applies to allocution at normal sentencing as opposed to a revocation?
Regarding the district court's requirement to request the defendant?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. The language they used was very much like the language of the old Rule 32.
Correct. And I'm not sure I can answer that as to the reasoning for it. It does seem to be perhaps an oversight. But
this language didn't place a direct requirement on the district court judge, did it? The new language.
The new language did not. That's correct.
Although that language was interpreted by the Supreme Court in the 1960s as placing the burden on the, or rather affording the individual a personal right, am I correct?
Placing the burden on the defendant to ask for it?
No. Placing the right on the individual. The Supreme Court said the old language did give him an individual right.
Correct. Correct. And I think if the court looks at the way any sentencing hearing, revocation or otherwise, occurs, most defendants do not feel free to suddenly speak up without being so invited by the court. I think in most district courts, the district court would invite the defendant.
Even the lawyers don't get chewed off their mouth unless the judge tells them to.
Well, if they're behaving well, that's true, Your Honor. But that's often the way the proceedings occur.
Turning to the last two prongs of the plain error test, even if this was error and it was plain, is there really prejudice here? And I wonder if this really is something where we ought to exercise any discretion to recognize it. She was told what was going to happen, and you come up with a dirty test. You're going to go away for 18 months. That was pretty clear to everybody in that courtroom.
That's true, Your Honor. Of course, that dovetails into my first argument that shouldn't have happened exactly that way, that the court should have considered lower sentences based on the guidelines and other factors. But I think regarding the last two prongs, the Supreme Court has recognized, as you say, the right of allocution. It's a substantial right that's been long recognized by courts in this country, and it gives the defendant herself, in this case, the opportunity to request for mercy, sometimes in a more eloquent way or definitely more personal way than a defense attorney can. And it's a rare situation where a party in a sentencing is not given a right to speak on their own behalf.
Well, does she have to be addressed by the judge in order to have an opportunity? I think the language of the requirement is you have an opportunity to allocute. Isn't that right?
That's the language, but my question would be, how is that practically going to happen? She most likely cannot stand up and say, Your Honor, I'd like to say something. I think in some cases her attorney might ask, my client would like to say something, but would always request permission from the judge before doing so. I think that the effect of the fairness, integrity, or public reputation is also an important prong in this case. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I will address that issue in my rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. We'll hear now from the government. Ms. Alibera.
Good morning. May it please the court, Karina Salavara on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, let me take up first the question of allocution. The parties are in agreement that the plain error standard applies here because there was no objection or...
Okay, we agree with that. But is it error?
Your Honor, we do not believe it is.
It wasn't error.
It was not error. It was not error under the then existing rule, as amended, of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure.
It wouldn't cost anything to say. Anything you want to say before I drop the bomb on you?
Also correct, Your Honor, and the better course here may have been for the government to suggest to the court that it's
firstly a freebie to go back down and do it down.
Well, Your Honor, the question here, though, is under the plain error standard, whether it's appropriate to, under the last part of the test concerning whether or not there's been a substantial error that seriously affects the fairness, the integrity.
The harmless error would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Correct.
And if I have a reasonable doubt, that means it can't be harmless error. If you have a reasonable doubt, it can't be harmless error. Do you have a reasonable doubt?
A reasonable doubt as to whether or not the proceedings would be different?
It's a violation of his constitutional rights, or her constitutional rights, not to ask for the allocution.
I do have a doubt as to that, Your Honor. The rule, the amended rule provides, and it's different from the rule that applies at the time of sentencing.
I understand that.
And so that's the source, Your Honor, of the disagreement, I believe, between the parties.
Well, you will admit there is a disagreement on the subject.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There you go.
You do with the fact that the Supreme Court, looking at the language in the 2005 amendment, said this gives the individual a personal right.
Your Honor, my understanding of the Supreme Court, well, I'm not aware of the earlier Supreme Court decision you're referring to, but I guess I understood your question to mean that the Supreme Court said, and then the rule at sentencing was amended to reflect, that, quote, the court must address the defendant personally in order to permit the defendant to speak or present any information. But it's a different rule at the time of the revocation of supervised release. And indeed, that's where we've joined issue. The rule is amended in connection with supervised release is the person is entitled to an opportunity to make a statement and present any information in mitigation. And I submit, Your Honors, that's what in fact happened here, and the reason the government didn't speak up and the court didn't catch the fact that she had not spoken directly. That's because the proceedings make clear the defendant had an opportunity.
How does it make clear? Did somebody say, you got anything you want to say?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. It wasn't made clear that she had an opportunity to speak. What was made clear was that she had an opportunity to present all the information she wanted to
That's different than the right of allocution.
That's correct, Your Honor, but having provided that information, her attorney said at the second hearing, the only thing the defendant asked is that she be sentenced somewhere near Chicago. The court...
Be confined somewhere near Chicago. That's right.
Correct.
That's not a waiver of allocution.
It's not allocution. That's correct, Your Honor. But it's the reason that the mistake, I submit, happened here. And it's the reason that the proceeding is not...
I stumbled on the word mistake as opposed to everything else.
An error, Your Honor, but not one that affected, again, the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceeding. And indeed... defendant doesn't argue what it is that she would have said or...
Nor does she have to.
She does not, except with respect to, Your Honor, this last part of the plein air standard. Again, the court in Reyna in the Fifth Circuit, in their en banc opinion, looked at a similar case where the district court had a lot of information, had a long, series of revocation issues with the defendant. And in that case, in those circumstances, the Fifth Circuit said, we do not see that the failure to provide expressly the opportunity to allocute affected the substantial fairness or the public perception of the proceedings. And I submit the same results should obtain here. The record makes very clear that over the course of two proceedings, the district court carefully considered the long history that this defendant had in connection with violations of the terms of supervised release with respect to drug abuse. And repeatedly, again, the record makes clear...
Did the Reyna court make any comment about the change in language of the rule?
The Reyna court did not. What it focused on was whether or not, in the circumstances of that case, where a plein air standard applied, there had been, again, the error that affected the fairness or the integrity of the proceeding. And they determined there was no such harm created because, again, of the circumstances that were carefully considered by the district court with respect to the appropriate
Even
sentence.
If we don't agree with you on the interpretation of the language of the rule, the 2005 amendment, your view is you should still prevail on the last prong because you don't see here, under the circumstances of this case, that there was any harm done, much less an impact on the public reputation of the proceedings.
That's correct, and that the court can be confident with respect to that part of the prong that there isn't a need to remand.
Let's go back to the antecedent question, though, the interpretation of the rule. Given the committee notes to the 2005 amendment, isn't it clear that what the framers of the 2005 amendment wanted to do was simply to extend the right to allocute as it existed in a regular sentencing proceeding to the revocation of supervised release?
I would agree, Your Honor. I have the advisory committee notes in front of me, and they say, quote, the court is required to give defendant the opportunity to make a statement. which I would also suggest would suggest the rule should track the language of the rule with respect to sentencing. Before imposing the sentence, the court must address the defendant personally. But that's not how the rule ended up being written.
No, but they could rely on the fact that the Supreme Court had interpreted the earlier language as giving the defendant the right to personally address the court. And the committee notes to the original, to the amendment to Rule 32 back in late 60s, makes it clear that it is simply to make something clear, not change a rule.
That would be a fair reading, Your Honor. But I would argue again that even if, as you put it, you disagree with the reading of the rule, you still could affirm, and we would request to affirm the sentence here, because there is not the serious effect on the fairness of the integrity or the public reputation of the judicial proceeding.
I understand.
Your Honors, with respect to the first argument that defendant makes, we submit simply, as we said in our brief, that the failure to make explicit reference to the non-binding guidelines here is not plain error. It was clearly before the court what the guideline range was, the fact that it was 3 to 9 months. The probation officer's two special reports before the court made clear that it was seeking the sentence of 18 months in order to address this ongoing, continuous, and recurring problem the defendant had with respect to drug abuse. Your Honors, for all the reasons stated this morning and in the government's brief, we request you affirm the sentence of revocation imposed by the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Salavara. How much time does Ms. Christensen have?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address the last prong of the plain error standard with regard to the allocution issue. As we argue in our brief, this error does affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of proceedings. As I said before, there's a long-recognized right. Prior to the rule change, every circuit court to consider the issue had mandated allocution at revocation. In addition, the public associates the right of a defendant to speak with sentencing. That is, in a layperson's point of view, one of the most important aspects of a defendant at sentencing. And it also would protect the court's integrity by allowing all parties to have a voice at a proceeding that decides the fate of the defendant. And finally, in contrast to the Reyna case, the Third Circuit in United States versus Plotz, which is cited in my brief, found that plain error did exist, and it was reversible plain error in this very situation. Reyna was a case where the defendant's conduct was repeated, but much more egregious than Ms. Petrie's. Granted, the repeated drug use and testing positive is serious. However, the defendant in Reyna had a serious criminal history that included additional violations of federal and state law.
Well, is it your position you don't have to show prejudice? Prejudice is automatic, or?
It's not necessarily that position, Your Honor. It's that it does affect her substantial rights, which can be equated to a prejudice analysis, but it does affect her substantial rights. And finally, I'd like to remind the court that Ms. Petrie did receive a sentence that will have her released at least to a halfway house at the end of November of this year, currently scheduled. So I've asked for expedited briefing and decision and would ask the court to certainly consider that if she were to have any benefit from this case. Unless the court has further questions, I would ask you to reverse and remand Ms. Petrie's sentence for reconsideration by the district court. Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel for their fine oral arguments today, and the case will be taken under advisement.